Jim Kawakami, the editor-in-chief of the very athletic Bay Area. Jim Kawakami.
Tim Kawakami, who's covered the NBA for over two decades, and more specifically the Golden State Warriors over the last 12 years.
This is the TK Show.
Hey everybody, it's Tim Kawakami, TK Show, recording from the home studio. I have on as my guest, frequent guest, friend of mine, person with a new job, Michael Silver, and a new NFL columnist for, I'm trying to check this place here, I'm not sure, it's this kind of undiscovered new outlet. I'm sure it's going to do, it's really scrappy coming up from upstart place. It's called The Athletic. I think I'm familiar with this. First of all, Michael, congratulations. Fantastic hire by The Athletic. I've said this publicly. I'll say it to you now. I hate saying it to your face, but I'll still say it. What a freaking great hire by The Athletic. But good. How's been? You were at the Chronicle for a couple of years. Obviously, you spent many years Yahoo and NFL Network and various other places in the Bay Area. What's this transition been like? What was this decision like to come to The Athletic?
Okay, well, first of all, congratulations to you as well. And you really are going to an upstart. And I'm so excited to watch you and the SF Standard. You've already done this once, but they are on the map and they're going to, you know, become a force. And very, very cool. So, yeah, we've never done a podcast, I think, where one of us doesn't work for The Athletic, but it's the other side.
Yeah, it's required. You're right.
Yeah, and listen, I'm really excited. I going from Sports Illustrated to Yahoo after 13 years.
Did I forget Sports Illustrated in there somewhere? Yeah,
yeah,
you were Sports Illustrated. Yeah,
but that was my weirdest one. Right, it was 2007. The world was changing, and very few people got it when I left my dream job at the height of it and went to Yahoo, which was building it. And so I've taken leaps before, but you're like the king of leaps. You started The Athletic basically. And when it was like, what's this thing, The Athletic? How is that going to work? And now it's like obviously a thriving operation. And then after doing that, you're like, I'm going to do it again in San Francisco. So yeah, like I feel like I've taken a leap before, but you're kind of like a different level of, cliff jumping.
I do appreciate that. Yeah. I mean, I don't do it just for that, but it is kind of fun. And what I'm proud of, and I'm going to say The Athletic Bay Area, they don't really consider it an entity anymore at The Athletic, but I do because we started it as an entity. I'm considering you as a part of that. I see you, Marcus, and Barros together in the media room yesterday. I'm going, geez, does that feel familiar? I do miss those. You know, I'm still obviously around them all the time and hopefully doing podcasts with Marcus, and I do a podcast with Barros. And I'm talking with you on a podcast, but I still feel a lot of, affection and a lot of, like, this thing's going to keep going, and I'm glad you're there. I'm glad you're there to write the stories you're writing. And I can only imagine what's coming next from you. So we've complimented each other enough, but I'll just say it out, with the Standard, I really wanted to come to Standard with you. Like, let's just say it. Like, we were talking, right? And it was a really attractive. Now, David Lombardi, we were going to load up on NFL, man. It was me and Lombardi and you. I thought, this is going to be such an over-indexing of the 49ers, the NFL. It's going to be great. We're just going to be the one-stop place. Yeah, there's many other people to read. I'm not saying that, but it would have been fantastic. You slipped through our fingers, Mike Silver, but you know that there's going to be people at the Standard reading you very closely in appreciation. So we knew what you were going to do.
Well, right back at you. Like, it's weird, right? Like, I'm still in my mind. I'm like, oh, Tim's there. I got to bring it today. Like, he knows a lot of stuff and he's really good. Lombardi's obviously super plugged in. I'm stoked to be working with Barros, of course. Marcus, like, what a gift.
Marcus you can put that way.
And then Eric Branch, I didn't really know him well, and just being his teammate for 2+ years was really, really fun. He's a grinder. He's old school. He makes me laugh. And so I was kind of like, I was working on my column yesterday, looking over at Branch, and I'm thinking like, well, this is weird. So it's all weird, but I think it's not unlike NFL players. Like, I think fans you know, after games would be shocked by the interactions. You know, someone just lost a hard-fought game, and then they see their former teammate or their former college teammate or a guy they trained with, and they're like, hey, you know, oh, man, you got me on that one. And it's, you know, not always, but it is – I do think as journalism changes and as they try to, you know, squeeze out the last remaining bits of our access and ability to do the job well for the consumer, those of us who are still journalists and attack it every day have even more of a camaraderie than we used to, because we, you know, of course we compete, that's part of the thing, but like, it, you know, I feel like if you're still a survivor and you still do this at a high level, it's almost like you have too much respect for each other to really compete in a bitter way like the old days.
Oh, those old New York, Philadelphia beats, man, that was unbelievable. I was part of the Philadelphia one, and it was a little rough there. But that's
hey, remember San Diego for a while?
Oh, God.
The three papers? That was an all-timer. Denver, there were some great ones.
And a little different now, but it's still, you know, we're still trying to do the best work we can. And we appreciate those who do it. And Branch is the best. I love Eric Branch. So I might have been at a dinner where there was a tearful speech by Eric Branch made about his comrade losing Mike Silver as a comrade. It was wonderful. It was wonderful stuff.
It was an incredible dinner until you got hit with the Seattle flu or whatever your horrible
that was terrible.
Bug was.
But I said, you know what, guys? I did say, I got up. I go, this was great. I got to go because I don't feel real good. I don't know how steady I looked walking out of there. But it
no,
was
you actually sold it so well. You had so much composure that when you group texted us the next day and told us that you'd essentially, you know, been vomiting for, you know, 9 straight hours or whatever, we were like, oh, no. Like, we just thought you, like, you know, had hot flashes or some, you know, weird thing. Anyway. Sorry.
it was rough. And there was more to come after I sent that text out to. I was hoping everyone else was okay. I got through it. But let's talk about this book. I am in the middle of it. It is, again, I hate telling you to your face, but it is so fucking good. The Why is Everything, about the Kyle Shanahan, Sean McVay, Matt LaFleur group of coaches. And Matt, you know, I wasn't expecting a bad book, certainly not, but I was expecting kind of like, you know, last few years they're talking amongst each other. And this is like a book on each one of the guys. That's how deep it goes. Just as a writer, Mike, and I know, you know, these book deals are made and then you go back and you know, you have a catalog of interviews, but how long were you really working on a book specific proposal? Because these conversations you're having are in the moment. They're like, at the time these decisions are being made, going back to, you know, decisions they made in Washington or Kyle in Cleveland, like, how long was this project in gestation in your mind, Mike?
Okay, well, first of all, thank you. I totally appreciate it. The Why is Everything. It's available everywhere. And I tried to write it not only for hardcore football fans, because it is taking you into this weird world that you and I inhabit, but you know, it's a great question, because covering the 49ers, you know, at the start of my career for the Sacramento Union and then the Santa Rosa Press Democrat, being down there every day, you know, one of the things that happened during that first stretch is Mike Holmgren had succeeded Bill Walsh as the play caller when George Seifert took over. And then he left to become the Packer coach after the 91 season. And they made kind of a curious hire to replace him from outside the Walsh tree. And it was Mike Shanahan. Mm-hmm. And at the time, it was a weird hire, because he kind of had the Lane Kiffin experience for Al Davis with the LA Raiders, for those of you who are a little bit younger. But he was a hot young coach. He went to coach for Al. They didn't get along at all, and he got fired pretty early in the middle of a season. And then he went back to Denver, where he'd had a bunch of success under Dan Reeves as an assistant, and ended up getting fired from there. And Dan Reeves accused him of insubordination, which was basically, I think Mike Shanahan and John Elway are like conspiring to call their own plays, which is ridiculous probably, but also, like, in retrospect, would you want Mike Shanahan and John Elway calling the plays, or would you want Dan? So And I knew Mike really well, and I saw him come there as this embattled guy. And Steve Young was also beleaguered because he wasn't Joe. He ran so much. He wasn't reading it out. And together they did this, you know, incredible transformation and culminating in that incredible Super Bowl 29 performance. And then Mike goes to Denver. Well, that's right around the time I went to SI. And so now I'm going to Denver all the time, and Mike wins the two Super Bowls. And Mike, unlike Kyle, Mike really did give me a lot of access, despite the fact that he had very similar sensibilities in general toward the media, although he was less honest than Kyle. And by the way, quick aside, thank you for all the great work you did in getting Kyle to open up, because it's weird. Like, you know, you and I are attribution freaks. Mm-hmm. And then when I would write the book, and most of it was, you know, interviews I had alone, but like, there's a lot of gold, like in your podcast, for example. So I would put that in the book and attribute, and then the editor would be like, nah, just you're going to do a sourcing notes chapter, you know, after every chapter. So just put that in there. It's so different from how we're wired, right? Yep. Like, we don't want to be those guys. But at some point I was like, okay, and like, you know, Jordan Rodriguez and Tim Kawakami and Seth Wickersham are going to read this book and be like, really, dude? But anyway, thank you for the good work. But so anyway, I was on that early, and honestly, like, Kyle and I did not have a good alignment on this particular project, but like, I've known him since he's 13. I've kind of quietly been rooting for him to succeed. I remember when he went to Houston, I was like so proud. I'm like, oh, that's the kid I knew. And now he's like calling plays for the Texans. And I've kind of lived his struggles, where Donovan McNabb and RG3 and Johnny Manziel and Roddy White, you know, and he had clashes. And people didn't understand how good he was, really, till that second year in Atlanta. And so part of it's just been, you know, germinating in my head. And then I think just covering the league nationally and seeing what was going on with that crew. And honestly, meeting Mike McDaniel really early on when no one knew him, and he's that quirky and that out there, and, you know, kind of having him not to myself, but in this kind of small world where he didn't really talk to people. And I started taping Mike, I think, in 2018, and I wasn't really sure why. I'm just like, something's there. There's some book about this crew. And then really during the pandemic, I kind of crystallized it, tried to figure out what it was. But, you know, you haven't gotten to the end, but as you can imagine, it was an evolving thing, because I did the deal, you know, in like late 2022, I think, I feel like. And, you know, we lived a lot of crazy after that, from Jimmy G coming back and Purdy and Trey Lance and last season and all those guys, Raheem Morris, Matt LaFleur, Mike McDaniel, Sean McVay, and Kyle went through all this stuff. And like, Sala was going to be a bigger part of the book, but Aaron got hurt. Staley was going to be a bigger part of the book, but you know, he got fired. So it really, like, Kevin O'Connell, if the book were being written this year, and Bobby Slowick would probably have to have chapters.
Yeah, I was going to ask about some of those. You know who I mean, I've always liked Raheem Morris. I met him, I think, once or twice early in his career. Haven't dealt with him since. I always appreciate the way he handles himself. But in the book, he comes off as like a, you know, a buffer almost, like a guy who can kind of talk Kyle down, who can talk offense, who obviously coaches defense. Big personality, but a big personality that people really like. Give us your sense of Raheem Morris. Explain to him kind of his part in this kind of, you know, that group of coaches.
Well, he's such a good story. He was recently promoted, like a couple weeks earlier, promoted to Buccaneers defensive coordinator as a young coach. And he had already met Kyle and Sean. So it's kind of interwoven. But he's getting ready to go out with Tiki Barber, Rondé Barber, who's a cornerback. So it's defensive coordinator player going to go out, you know, after the season. And he gets a call that he has to come into the facility, and he doesn't know why. And he, you know, he cancels the plan with Tiki, and he goes in, and he finally realizes that the owners, the Glazers, are telling him, "We want you to be the head coach of the Buccaneers." And he's like, "What are you talking about? John Gruden's the head coach." And they're like, "We're firing John," which was a huge surprise at the time. And Raheem was young, and he, at first he said no. Gruden ended up texting him and saying, "Go for it. You know, they're firing me anyway." So he takes that job. They rebuild. They're young. They have Josh Freeman at quarterback, who's not very mature. And Raheem admittedly was not nearly as mature then. And so he was, you know, just not very buttoned down. And through all that, they had a great second season, went 10-6, almost made the playoffs anyway. But he got fired and then kind of had to build it back up, first in Washington, where Kyle helped get him hired on that Mike Shanahan staff. And then later in Atlanta, where Kyle ends up switching him to offense and he becomes a receivers coach. So he's super well-rounded. So like Raheem's got this incredible personality, as you saw, like he's so charming and naturally funny that he can kind of say brutal stuff to people and have them receive it in a way that, you know, others, it wouldn't work. And, you know, one of my favorite stories in the book, and I don't want to spoil it for you if you haven't gotten there, but it's probably worth it. So, Raheem is the interim coach of the Falcons after Dan Quinn gets fired after that 2020 season, and interviews for the head job after the season, doesn't get it. They give it to Arthur Smith. So now he's got a bunch of options, and he gets a call from Urban Meyer, who is about to become the Jaguars head coach. And Urban's like, "I've heard great things about you. I want you to be my defensive coordinator." And at the time, Raheem's thinking that might be a good option, you know, given what I have. So it's like a Friday, and Urban says, "Hey, why don't you come down here on Wednesday? We'll do the interview and we'll finalize it." And Raheem's thinking, yeah, that's five extra days, because Urban is so clueless about how the NFL works and how competitive it is and the hiring cycle and how fast it moves, that he's thinking, "I got my guy for defensive coordinator. I'll get to him in 5 days." And what Raheem understands is that's 5 days more of options. And so during that time, Brandon Staley gets fired, or gets hired as the Chargers head coach, leaving McVay without a defensive coordinator. And Raheem's at dinner with his wife having steak and gets a call from Sean the night before he's supposed to go to Jacksonville. And Sean's like, "Bro, come to LA." And eventually that's what he does and helps them win a Super Bowl. So think how different it went for Raheem Morris going to LA with Sean instead of walking into that Urban Meyer, you know, shit show. That's probably, like, maybe you could argue it's the worst head coaching performance in NFL history. It's on the Mount Rushmore, I think.
Yeah, the guy getting paid that much, obviously, with that kind of power. Hey, as we look at, you know, we'll get to 49ers season. I look at some of these guys, though. You know, Sala, we'll see how that, you know, if that lasts with the Jets. I mean, I'm sorry, he's gone, fired by the Jets. Yeah. Ulbrich is the interim coach. We'll see if that lasts. We know you quoted Ulbrich directly that he was chased by Shanahan to be defensive coordinator this season, and the Jets blocked it, and he's now interim head coach. Could you see, you know, McDaniel? I don't know what's going to go on with the Dolphins with Tua in some question. Could you see, is the relationship such that if they're without a job or Sala currently, like, could you see these guys wanting to return to Shanahan staff next season?
Wow, that's such a good question. You know, Sala, I think he and Kyle, you know, Kyle yelled at him a lot. Sala yelled back. They had a whole thing. But, you know, they went through a lot of stuff together, as you know better than I do, because you were there more. Those first 2 years, there was no guarantee Sala was going to survive. And then they got Kasarek and did the wide nine and got Bosa.
I was not going to say they got Bosa. That helped it.
Not insignificantly. Yeah. And D4. Like, yeah. So I think Sala and Kyle are good. And I think, you know, if Kyle asks Sala to look at their tape this year and just get a fresh set of eyes on it, I could see that happening, you know, off the books or otherwise. McDaniel and Kyle is complicated because McDaniel absolutely is indebted to Kyle for all the opportunities that he took him everywhere with him. And Mike had all those personal struggles, alcohol, and Kyle, you know, he owes Kyle a lot and he knows it, but he also felt held down in a lot of ways and was very good, was like, you know, took a lot off Kyle's plate. Not that Kyle doesn't ultimately oversee it and isn't capable of doing it all himself, because he is that good. But like, knowing Mike could handle a lot of the running game at a high, high level and know what Kyle wants, for example, you know, was a huge asset to Kyle, which is why Kyle didn't want to let him go. So there's a chapter I want to come back on after you read the chapter in the book called The Liberation of Mike McDaniel, with some really, there's some wild details in there about how hard Kyle tried to keep him when the Dolphins were sniffing around. And so I feel like McDaniel probably wouldn't, and maybe Kyle wouldn't want, I don't know. Kyle might want it. I think McDaniel wouldn't and Sala would.
Yeah, interesting. Because, you know, he's lost all these guys, but like some of them might become available again. He just kind of cycles through, and or is he just, you know, grooming the people, you know, still he got Clay Kubiak now, right? So, you know, maybe he can just keep going through that way.
I will say this about Kyle, because there's, you know, there's a lot in the book that suggests that he's a hard guy to work for, and that once you're gone, he kind of excommunicates you. It's just, you know, not like I'll never speak to him again, but like he was here and now he's not with us. Mm-hmm. We don't talk about him. But weirdly, when Mike LaFleur, so the intertwined, you know, Mike LaFleur, Matt's younger brother, was Sala. Sala took him from Kyle. Basically, he asked Kyle, can I have Mike LaFleur, Mike McDaniel? And Kyle said, fine, you can have Mike LaFleur, but I'm keeping McDaniel. And so Mike LaFleur goes to the Jets as the offensive coordinator, gets handed Zach Wilson, and it doesn't go well. And at the end of year two, Woody Johnson, one of my one of the owners I love to bash for being an idiot and a million other reasons, basically tells Sala, you have to fire Mike LaFleur. So as this is playing out late in the season, Kyle starts checking in with Mike LaFleur every week. And Mike's like, this is weird. I know Kyle, even if he means well and we're cool, he doesn't call people during the season. And he saw it as a sign of two things. One, wow, I'm really touched that Kyle is being a friend to me right now. And two, he must love Brock Purdy so much that he's this comfortable making phone calls. Like, he must really like be. And that's the year, you know, Purdy got thrown in. So there's this funny thing where, of course, Mike LaFleur ends up getting hired by Sean McVay, and it hasn't come out yet. And he's dreading the call from Kyle, where he has to tell Kyle, who's been so good to him now, hey, by the way, I'm going to the Rams. And the phone rings, and he, and Mike and his wife, Lauren, are getting ready to go out. And Mike's like, I don't want to take this. And Lauren's like, you got to take this. You have to do it. So Mike gets on the phone, and Kyle's like, so what's up, man? And Mike kind of starts stammering, and Kyle already knows. So Kyle kind of graciously goes, I know, you're going with Sean. And Mike's like, wow, he's not reacting. And then in the background, Mandy, Kyle's wife, you know, is like, bleep you, Mike. You know, and everyone starts laughing. So I think sometimes the wrath of Mandy might be stronger than the wrath of Kyle.
I've heard this. I have heard this, by the way. You mentioned Kyle maybe wasn't in line exactly with this book. What did he tell you? What was his kind of approach to you doing this book?
You know, it's interesting because I've known him for so long. And again, I've taken like pride in his accomplishments. I've defended him a lot, not because, oh, I love Kyle, just because I have thought he's good for a long time. And I've been kind of, you know, sympathetic to his side of a lot of these situations. And, you know, and I've been out with him at league events and had beers and, you know, and there's a part of him that, you know, I think we get along pretty well. I think me coming to the Chronicle and being down there a lot disrupted the ecosystem for better or worse. And that's not really, you know, personal, I don't think, but it did. I think it just made it weirder for both of us. My style is very like, you know, like I tried to walk him to the bus in Houston the first preseason game, and he kind of freaked out, and I didn't understand why he freaked out, because I do that all the time, and he didn't understand why I would think he would freak out, because he says it's never happened. So it just took us a while, and then, you know, in the meantime, I'm writing and, you know, writing about some pretty charged things and reporting, and so I think it just got out of whack a little, and then I just always assumed that we'd have a beer and talk about the book. And we kind of talked about doing something. And then he just abruptly over the 2023 offseason just said, in very stark terms, I told you I'm not doing this, which he hadn't. And then we had like two very long, gnarly phone conversations that in one day before and after an offseason practice that, you know, I think we both ended up regretting. We both apologized later, and then I think have tried to make it good ever since, because I know, speaking for me, like I don't want it to be bad with Kyle. I like him. And, you know, I think I went too far, and he probably thinks he went too far. So after that, it just was like, we've been cool. He's helped me. He's given me access in conjunction with my, you know, normal job. And obviously a lot of that helped with the book a ton. So unlike the other ones who sat down with me and talked me through a lot and talked on tape for the book, Kyle never really did that with me. I don't think it reads that way. I think there's enough there because, you know, I was in his office after they beat the Eagles in Philly. You know, I've gotten some good access to him too. So I just think, I don't want to speak for him, but I believe his attitude would be, I don't want a book on me while I'm still coaching. And my perspective was, it's not on you, it's on the whole group. And, you know, it's really a book about a change in football that you've been at the forefront of. And in his mind, like, I don't want a book on me. I don't want it to be done, period. And since you're doing it anyway, that does not please me.
It's in some ways it's about his guys all talking about him, right? That's kind of interesting. You know, like, sure. He's such the central force that you can do it about him because his influence is so strong on all these guys.
Yeah, no, I mean, and listen, like, I don't want to mince words. Like, all these guys are really, really good and really smart and strategically ahead. But Kyle's the guy. Like, there was a dynamic in Washington where Mike's the head coach, Kyle's the OC, and they'd go running into Kyle's office like, hey, what do you think of this? And he would either go, yeah, maybe, or he'd be like, get out of my office. But they're still on some level looking for his approval. And if you gave them all truth serum, maybe not McDaniel, who is, you know, as it says in the book, he's Matt Damon, how do you like them apples smart? But like, I think McVay, Matt, and Raheem, who are so smart, if you gave them truth serum, would all go, yeah, well, Kyle's another level ahead of us just on scheme. You know, McVay would say leadership is so important, and I'm so good with that. But like, if it's just who is capable of, you know, mapping it out and calling it at the absolute highest level of football, I think Kyle's the guy.
Let's just talk about the Chiefs game coming up. Obviously, the team has beaten them four straight times in the Kyle era, two Super Bowls, the last Super Bowl. Steve Spagnuolo has been the DC on the other side all four times, and Reed's been head coach. Mahomes has been the quarterback. But the Shanahan-Spagnuolo thing, I mean, Spagnuolo's beaten him in two huge games, has shut his offense down at the end both times. What is it about Spagnuolo? Do you think this – I know it bugs Kyle. So how much does it bug Kyle that he can't beat, hasn't been able to beat this guy?
Well, it's funny because like the Kyle kryptonite thing is always a weird thing. Like Jim Schwartz has this incredible record against him. And now, as you brought up Spagnuolo, and remember, Spagnuolo was the Giants defensive coordinator when they beat the 18-0 Patriots. And that's how he became a head coach, which he wasn't great at. But, you know, that's been a thing. You know, I guess I don't understand scheme so well that I could tell you conclusively that the Super Bowl was totally about scheme. It seems to be like, you know, Burford missed an assignment, right? And that blew up the one huge play. You had, you know, you have a quarterback who I think is already very elite and ascending, but it was a young quarterback in his first Super Bowl. And he played well, but like there may have been a couple of, you know, Brock Purdy at 27 might shred those schemes, you know, in the same situation. And I know there's, you know, it seems to have informed their offseason thinking and extending to the drafting of Pearsall and the arguable overpaying of Ayuk based on how they think of him. But they felt like there wasn't, receivers weren't getting separation against that scheme in those key moments, right? That they need more of that. And that I think Pearsall was part of that idea. And the fear of losing Ayuk, which there was a point, and you know, look, they were going to trade him until Kyle went sprinting up the stairs, which is another crazy thing. But like the fear of losing Ayuk to me was outsized in terms of how good he really is and what the number is and what else they could have done, you know, including keep Debo. Like it just, Ayuk's really good. He's important. They groomed him. He matured. He got better. He seemed to have matured largely. But, like, you know, at some point you're like, he's not, you know, Justin Jefferson. He's not Jamar Chase. You can draft receivers and get them cheap. Like, it just, with all they have going on, it seemed at the end like it was an overpay. But I think part of that was Kyle just going, I on third down, I need a guy who I know is separating in my scheme. So I don't know how much of it is Spagnuolo. I think probably Kyle, it's just everything is dwarfed by I've got to win the Super Bowl, you know, because of the way he had to take the Atlanta loss on himself when that should be on Dan Quinn. And then the two Super Bowls, he is the poster child for can't win the big one. And obviously so close this last time. I don't think he sees it as Andy Reid. I don't think he sees it as Spagnuolo. He may see it as Mahomes, understandably.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I think you and I might agree. Like, I just think for Kyle, it's just the thing. I have to win a Super Bowl somehow. That is the thing. And unless and until that happens, it's not about one guy or one team or one, you know, scheme. It's just, I gotta do that.
Let's see if they play him again in the Super Bowl. Then it really might be something like that.
Yeah, right.
I mean, that would be incredible. And, you know, listen, having covered the Warriors and Cavaliers in four straight NBA Finals, I'm almost expecting this now. This is like the what happens for some of these teams.
There's a scene in the book where after Super Bowl 54, Kyle is walking back to his room that night, and he's with Bo Scaife, who played tight end in the NFL for a long time, played with Kyle at Texas, close friend of his, actually grew up in Colorado and knew Kyle toward the end of their high school days. But Kyle and Bo Scaife are walking to Kyle's room, and Kyle turns and says, I feel like God doesn't want me to win a Super Bowl. I'm sure times two now. Unbelievable. Yeah.
Yeah. Darkness over that franchise in the days, hours, and seconds after Super Bowl losses. I will attest to that. All right, we could go on and on. We will do another show in not too long after I finish the book. But we've talked so much about the book. It is. I would encourage people to buy it and read it. It's really good. And I try not to always talk about books because many people write books. And I don't want to not talk about other people's books, but this one is just so rich. Enough of that. All right. I'll end this with a version of the question I've asked you before. And I ask all my guests, this is the first time I'm going to ask this specific one. It is request by the guest. This one is but it might be a request by other guests after I ask it. Mike Silver, what's your favorite beer?
I'm so glad you asked because my friends at the Seattle Seahawks sent me a coaster and a hat. This is Manny's Pale Ale. Now, you saw me drinking it the other night.
Yes.
You can't really get, I think a couple of San Francisco bars allegedly have it, but you really have to get it on tap in Seattle. It's Georgetown is the brewery, Georgetown Manny's. I got turned on to this beer by John Schneider, the general manager of the Seahawks. What happened was there was this great beer, it kind of as the microbrew revolution, the craft beer, you know, started happening. Past, you know, there was Red Hook, and then there was this second wave with like Vidmer and Portland and some of the other ones. Mac and Jack's African Amber, which is a Seattle beer, came up, and I had that, and I was like, wow, because it's a pale ale, so that's an African Amber, but it's basically like it's not an IPA. You know, you're not getting the high percentage where it's going to, you know, old people like us, we don't want to always be that buzzed. And then, you know, really smooth. And Schneider, I was out with him and I started to order a Mac and Jack's. He goes, no, you got to get a Mandy's. And I started drinking it. And I was like, oh my God, this is even better. And he goes, here's the story as I understand it. The guy who started Mandy's, or maybe Georgetown Brewery, worked at Mac and Jack's and decided he was going to make his version of it, but without all the sugar. I guess there's way more sugar in, allegedly, this is all, I'm quoting John Schneider, this may not be true, don't sue me, but it was portrayed to me that this is a version of Mac and Jack's, which, by the way, I would drink a Mac and Jack's happily, it's great, but that if you're trying to cut some calories and have less sugar, this is an even better version. So I freak out on Mandy's Pale Ale. I like, you know, it's kind of like Spotted Cow in Wisconsin. Like you go there, you're like, I want that so bad. But it's a good thing I don't live where it flows on tap, because I don't need to be drinking that much beer.
I have had, not that night, but I have had Mandy's in previous trips, and it is excellent, excellent beer.
By the way, this is in the conversation. I realize okay. I'm wearing field work, which is, a Bay Area treasure. I realize I'm like a billboard today. I've got like, I never understood this. Like I went to the Fieldwork Brewery in Berkeley and the tap room or whatever, and bought the shirt. And it's Cal colors, kind of. I was like, yeah. This is awesome.
I thought it was a Cal shirt, by the way.
But like, shouldn't they pay me to wear the shirt?
Yes.
You know,
yes.
It's free advertising. I never understood that. Like, I also like, one of my pet peeves is logo shirts in airports, right? Like, guys walking through an airport and he's wearing like the so and so construction or IBM or whatever. It's just, I don't like the look. And I remember this. At NFL Network, you know, we always used to have to wear the NFL polos during training camp, which is good. So we don't have to wear suits on the air. We can wear those. But like, I was on a tight schedule and had to rush to the airport from, you know, Eagles or something to get to the next camp. And I'm like rushing through the airport when I realized like I'm wearing the worst possible thing. I'm wearing an NFL Network polo. So I had to go into my bag. And I had like a sweatshirt and it was probably like, you know, 1,000 degrees with 1,000% humidity, but I still wore the sweatshirt over the NFL logo rather than have the NFL Network polo on in the airport.
Just wait till you get all that athletic garb though, Mike. You'll be suited up, suited and booted.
Is there standard garb yet?
No, that's one thing, man. It would be great. I don't think there is. And even the athletics kind of pulled back in the early days, man. We had the garb everywhere. Even got Durant to wear a hat. It was hilarious.
I remember at SI.
Steph wore a hat too once.
That's a bit. Yeah, at SI, like, I think I just missed it. Right when I got there, the people they sent to Lillehammer for the Winter Olympics got this incredible, you know, ski jacket that said Sports Illustrated. Kind of small, too, and, like, the rings and stuff. And I'm like, I would have taken the job just for the damn jacket.
They'll get you some garb. They'll get you some athletic garb. Mike, I know you got something else. I want to get you out here, but I could talk to you forever. We often do, but very glad. Great to have you on. And the Why is Everything. That's the book. It's behind his shoulder right now on the screen if you are watching. And I would encourage everyone to buy and read this book. All right, Mike, thank you so much.
Thank you, and make sure everyone to bookmark the SF Standard, because if you don't do it now, you're going to have to do it later anyway, because it's becoming a thing. Everybody bookmark SF Standard and go there.
All right. Thanks so much, Mike. Appreciate it. That's the show for today.